Time to take a look at the wonderful world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Really happy to have him with us once again. Certainly, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be here.
You know what? Every one of our lines is filled already.
It's been a buggy year, I can tell you that.
But not for mosquitoes.
No, well, that's the one blessing of not having this rain. I mean, if you just don't have puddling water, you're not going to have mosquitoes. Now, the one other caveat to that, though, is that you may still see some West Nile issues in the state. And the main reason is the mosquito that does that breeds in polluted water that's found in old tires and in bird baths and stuff. And so even though we're not getting the flooding rains that give us the nuisance mosquitoes, we still could potentially have some disease issues to be careful with.
Okay. Well, Joanne and Rhinelander, we'll give you a chance right out of the gate here. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I have two questions. We have two rustic cabins, and we're in quite a woody area. And recently, a friend of ours slept in one of the bunks, and he woke up the next morning with an enormous number of bites around his neck, around his ankles, and around where the seam of his undershirt goes, where the arm is attached to the body.
Mm-hmm.
And he never saw any bugs. But I saw the bites. There were many, many bites. They itched a great deal. And eventually the itching went away, but several days later you can still see the bites, although they are fading.
Mm-hmm.
He went to a doctor. The doctor said, I've never seen anything like it. And we don't know what it is.
Sure. Well, I mean, two things come to mind in that situation. The first one, to be honest, are mites associated with birds and, to some degree, rodents. There are some parasitic mites. They're small enough to probably be overlooked. You wouldn't necessarily feel the bite, but one of the characteristics is they almost blister, it seems, in many people. And again, in a cabin where you may have had some birds nesting in the roof or whatnot, that would be the first thought. The second one is that there is a bed bug associated with bats. And again, if you had bats roosting in the structure, the bed bugs would feed on you, although traditionally the bites are more mosquito-y bite-like but they will readily feed on humans, these bed bugs, even though we are not a true host and they can't breed off us. So I'm thinking more of that kind of association. And as I said, in the case of the bird mites, it would look like walking pepper grains. They're big enough to see on a light background, but they are quite small.
Okay. Could it possibly be chiggers?
Well, chiggers are typically contacted outside. And it's so characteristic, the extreme length of the bites. But one of the classic things about chiggers is almost all the bites are where clothing seaming is. And so, you know, either the sock line, you know, your comments with the bites above the neck in the more exposed skin doesn't seem like chiggers. What makes chiggers so difficult, though, is that it often takes 24 hours or more to get the reaction, so people don't often associate. So, yes, he could have been exposed outside, but as I said, just the way the bites were presenting, I'm suspicious it's not.
Okay.
My other question is, how would you get rid of powder post beetles? We have those also.
Sure. The best product is basically a sodium octaborate, which is like boric acid, and it's sold under a number of commercial names. I think the two I see most dominant is Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R, which is a powder base that you mix with water. The other one is Boracare, B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E. That's a glycol base that you also mix with water. In order for this to work on wood, it has to be, you know, farm sawed, rough cut, unfinished, or at least weathered enough that when you paint this stuff on, it can diffuse in. If the wood is sealed in any form, to be honest, you have to sand that sealing off. But you put the borate treatment on, and it will soak into the wood, and then you can go through whatever kind of sealants or staining you would like. In fact, on outside, you have to seal it in because it is water-soluble enough that it would leach off if you didn't. But the nice thing about that is it's somewhat less toxic than some of the old insecticides we used. And it's really permanent. I mean, once it's in there, it doesn't go away. And it's something you could put on with a paintbrush or a very low-pressure sprayer, so you don't necessarily need professional help. There's nothing fancy or dangerous with putting this stuff on. And so that has been a real good solution to a problem that, to be honest, 20 years ago, we didn't have that good of a solution for.
Yeah. Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Joanne, for calling. Marilyn in Kansasville, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wondered if Phil could speak a little bit about leaf rollers. Earlier this season, I would say in June, my grandsons were visiting, and as we walked up our road, we would find fallen hickory leaves that were all rolled up, and it was most interesting to open them up and find larvae in various stages of development. And then also we would see other critters in there that I assume were not even related to the leaf roller. So I wondered if you could tell a little bit about the species or the order of animal that is making the leaf and how they're able to construct such a neat roll. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Sure. Well, you know, all the leaf rollers I normally associate are moth and caterpillars. In fact, there's one or two families of moths we often refer to the leaf rollers, although there are some other species that do this. Some of them are real generalists you find on all kinds of broadleaf trees. Other ones are very host-specific. And some of them even go farther than just rolling it up like a cigar. Some of them construct tube-like structures made up of various components of vegetation. But what happens is this is kind of a protected device. And they're really related to the bagworms, if anybody's ever seen a bagworm, which do the same thing, except they're kind of a mobile leaf roller in that they construct their case around them and move, whereas the leaf roller lives within the leaf. In that protected environment, of course, it's protected against a lot of predators, although we still find wasps and birds and other things can get at them. But after their 3 or 4 weeks of feeding, they often will spin their cocoon in that sheltered case and then leave. And, of course, once that leaf has been usually rolled together and tied with silk, much like they use for their cocoons, then they fly off as the moth. And many times, most leaf rollers I see are very active in May when the leaves are still expanding, although we do have some later season ones. And if I had to guess, it wouldn't surprise me that we have probably 60 or 70 species of moths that are capable of doing leaf rolling in Wisconsin.
Interesting. Thanks for calling. Dan in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. I noticed this summer the ant colonies in this yard, which is rural, are far less than 1% of normal. There has also been a dearth of yellow jackets. I would think it is incredible if it is a highly localized phenomenon. Does colony collapse disorder affect other species of Hymenoptera or only Apis mellifera?
I have seen nothing to indicate that the collapse disorder spreads to other bees, wasps, and the like. And in fact, you know, that's still a open-ended question, what causes it, although I did see a very interesting paper come out of Spain that was suggesting it is a protozoan parasite that is underlying. Now, it remains to see if that's proven. But it's interesting. Yellow jackets, to be honest, I'm expecting to have a somewhat better than normal year. And I really, the two things that I think are going to influence that, it was a dry spring and it's been somewhat warm. And those two combinations usually give us a lot of yellow jackets. I have been getting a lot of ant complaints. So, again, from least my perspective in the lab, the ants are as strong, if not stronger, than normal. And so I'm not quite sure what the phenomena is why things are on the other side where you're located.
Interesting.
How do ant colonies overwinter?
Most of the big colonies we have overwinter in the ground with their queens and workers. And in fact, the big field ants, which are the ones that tend to make the bigger colonies in mounds that we see out in the field and prairies and the like, those colonies can go for 15 or 20 years. Once the queen dies, though, unlike the honeybee, which is capable of producing new queens and keeping the colony going, the ant colony is dead in most cases. We do have some species of ants that have multiple queens. They are capable then of keeping going, but most of those then tend to break apart, almost like the bee swarming to spread, you know, where queens will go off with certain workers and create satellite colonies. But, you know, most of our ant species are capable of going a number of years. And again, their secret is they kind of quiet down, almost go dormant in the winter and overwinter with their queens and then start raising young again in the spring, very similar to bees.
How deep do they go in the ground?
Oh, easily 3 or 4 feet. Some of these prairie species are really quite amazing. And, you know, being cold-blooded as insects are, they can tolerate much cooler temperatures than a mammal could, but they really do go through almost a hibernation. We call it diapause is the term, but physiologically they're very much slowed down, and of course with that you're burning less food reserves, which is one of the ways they can get through the winter.
Thanks, Daniel, for calling. Appreciate it. Pat in Mazamani, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have two questions also. The first is about a spider that I've been noticing on a rose when it's in bloom, and it's an aggressive spider. It's a white one, about a half inch long, and it's got a brown horseshoe on the top of its abdomen, and it literally lies in wait for bumblebees and then springs on them, shoots something in them that paralyzes them, and eats
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm guessing it's a crab spider, and we have a number. In fact, some of the crab spiders are white with pink markings, and they sometimes refer to them as flower spiders. But that's their behavior, is to lie in ambush and often be quite well camouflaged, and then pounce on their prey. And then, as typical of spiders, they have the venom that will paralyze the prey relatively quickly, and then they can eat them. And so I'm sure it's one species or another of what we would call a crab spider.
Are there more spiders around this year? Because I see furry brown ones that kind of jump when I budge the plant, too. And is that more typical of dry weather? Or?
Well, I tend to see more spider webs and things because I don't think they get washed away. And so that's what I've seen so far, is that the spiders are more visible than normal. And some of that, I think, is, as they said, the webs that are often produced almost on a daily basis just aren't getting washed away. And so they kind of accumulate. But it's interesting. It's almost getting to the point now. It's getting dry enough. You know, I know some critters that will do well in the dry weather, but I think it's getting stressful to some of the insects too, especially as these plants tend to get into major stress that will influence the things that feed on them. And so it will be interesting if this kind of drought continues, to see what the impact will be in the next couple of weeks.
Huh. Then the other question I had was about tent-type caterpillars. I don't know if they have successive generations, but we have never found them on birch trees before. But we just took some off a birch tree about a week and a half ago, and they're about 1 inch long, and they're developing creamy fuzz, and they have 10 opposing black spots.
Yeah, this one is one we refer to as the fall webworm. The one in the spring only goes through one generation and confines its feeding to flowering fruit trees, and that's the eastern tent caterpillar.
Uh-huh.
Fall webworm is capable of going through a couple generations, but we tend to only see it in July and August. And as you mentioned, birch would be one of the plants. I see them quite a bit on walnut. And so they don't seem to have a real fondness for the flowering fruit trees, although you would still see them on apple. And we tell people, even though they're very visible, they're, you know, if they're reachable, fine, but if they're, you know, 20 feet up in the tree, they really don't do that much damage. And so we don't get too concerned about having to climb a tree to get rid of them. But if, you know, it's low enough on a tree, you can easily cut it and destroy it. The major point, I guess, is that, trees tolerate insect feeding much better now towards the end of summer than they do in the spring when they're kind of weak and coming out of the winter. So.
Great. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Phil, we get a book called Zoo Books, a magazine for my daughter, and there was they always devote an issue to a particular species, and they had one on spiders recently that was pretty interesting. We've had a couple of questions about spiders. I did not know there are many strange ways that there are interesting ways that they hunt, including one that is called a web throwing spider, I believe it is. It actually makes a web and throws the web to capture its prey, and they had a great picture of one.
Yeah, I mean, spiders are fascinating, and it's interesting. I tend to get a number of calls every year on spiders and identification, and fortunately, to identify a spider properly, I have to see its face, its eyes, how they sit. You know,
right.
It's really more technical, and it's kind of hard to describe. And I think part of it is people just don't appreciate how much diversity, how many species.
Yeah.
And, we've got trapdoor spiders and just all kinds of neat things. And the good news is you can make the argument they're all beneficial because they eat insects and other things that we probably don't want to have around in some cases. And the other thing, I guess, they get far more bad press than they deserve. What we find is better than 95% of what people present as spider bites are not. I mean, it's not mm-hmm. a spider's nature to go out and bite people. So when you wake up in the morning and you got mysterious bites, it's probably not a spider.
All right, on to Pat in East Troy. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Larry and Phil. Thank you so much for having this program. It's very opportune. I just was outside setting a hose and found that bees had set up housekeeping in an old chipmunk hole, and I need to get rid of them quickly. mm-hmm. before they get more established and get somebody.
Sure. And, you know, and that's, I think, the thing that we often weigh for people is that these ground nesting, both bumblebees and yellow jackets, the colonies get stronger as the season goes on, and that's when they're most defensive. If it's an area that would you've got a lot of traffic, if it was out away from people, we'd say it's probably best to let them be. What I find with anything that nests in the ground or goes into a wall or goes into a house, that dusts are better than sprays. And part of that has to do with we don't really know where the nest is versus the opening. And probably the easiest dust for people to find is the 7 garden dust, although there is a permethrin dust and a deltamethrin dust that you will also see at the nursery stores. And the other suggestion is wait until about 7 o'clock at night, you know, when things are kind of quieted down, and then just give a good dusting to the entrance. Unfortunately, the 7 isn't not immediate, unlike the wasp sprays that will freeze them in midair. But again, with a little care there, you can dust the entrance, and you will find by the next day it does them in very quickly. Why you don't want to treat in the middle of the day is that the workers that are out and about foraging, when they come back, will probably refuse to go back in the nest and be quite agitated. You know, so it is a mistake to treat them in the middle of the day. After a day or two, if you notice there's no activity, then you can plug the hole and, you know, use dirt or whatnot. It's not a good idea to plug a hole before the nest is dealt with, because then they can find 3 or 4 ways out, and then all of a sudden we have kind of multiplied the problem rather than solved it directly. But they said dusts in 7 dust is probably the easiest one to find at the hardware store and the like.
All right.
I will go right out and take the rock off that I put on it 5 minutes ago. Yeah.
Well, you know, but that one, as long as there's an opening, you know, for now what I would do is rather, because they're not going to be happy about you being around there. They're probably going to be kind of agitated. Other than, as I said, if it's totally closed out, what I'd be concerned about is these workers coming back and getting agitated. And so then it may be worth taking the risk and get a stick or something just to move that rock away.
Okay. Putting a hose down the hole wouldn't do any good.
Usually not. I think a lot of the chipmunk burrows are already engineered in a way that the excess water goes off, and so there's a chamber that's up and out of the way, and that's, I bet you, where the nest is itself. And so these are not diggers, but they're good at using those old rodent burrows, and as I said, usually they're constructed in a way. And that's also why the aerosols don't work, because the aerosol just treats and soaks into the area right at the entrance, and the nest, to be honest, could be a foot or two away.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you so very much.
You bet, Pat. Thank you for calling. Don in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a very small flying insect, and it's usually in the basement, but I have been seeing it in, like, the kitchen area, the bathroom area. The body is probably less than an eighth inch long, and the wings are about 4 times as big, and it's a dark color, almost black. And if you do squish it, you get this black residue.
Like powder?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a family of moths that we call moth flies or drain flies. And moth fly comes from that fact that they are powdery, which is not typical of most flies. And drain fly really more refers to the habitat. They breed in areas that are kind of slimy and wet. And if you've got, like, your kitchen drain, you tend to wash too much water through it. It won't accumulate. But things like floor drains in the bathroom, sometimes even showers and the like, just the way the drains are constructed, you get this buildup of this kind of goop,
right.
And that's where they will come from. So the first thing is I would suggest getting a good hot pail of water and flush in the bathroom or the basement floor drain, which often doesn't see much water.
Okay.
And that sounds like where the main source would be.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I have seen these things breeding in rotting onions and those kind of things that, again, are getting kind of slimy and kind of wet. But traditionally,
yeah, we don't have any food sitting out. So.
Yeah, traditionally, it's more floor drains in drains that don't get flushed very often with water. And that's why you get this accumulation of goop. Now, in very difficult situations, sometimes you need some kind of bacterial digester to cut through this stuff. The one thing I'll guarantee that will not work is bleach. People often tell me they put bleach down, and all it does is sterilize the outside slime layer.
Yeah, I have done that.
So as I said, the hot pail of water, I think, tends to both physically kill them, but also will cut through some of that goop. And that's what you want to do is get that loosened up and flush through, and then you won't have a food source for the maggots.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for calling, Don. And on to Mark in Green Bay. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
A couple of weeks ago, I had a bear come through my front yard and took down 7 swallow houses and ate the young. As I was reconstructing them, they were just crawling with mites or lice or whatever. I was wondering if there's something that's safe to put inside the box when the young are nesting that might take those out or cut down their population.
Well, you know, for chickens and other birds, we use a permethrin dust to get rid of the red mites is one of the things they refer them to. And so that would be a possibility. And again, permethrin you will see sold under the name 8, among other things. But you may be better off because of, you know, legally, if the use is not on the label, you can't use the product, even though it's the same active ingredient. So you may have to go to a pet store to get some permethrin dust, which is labeled again for birds, and put that in there. And that will give you about 3 weeks worth of residual. So it's not a permanent solution, but it is a way of knocking some of those parasites down. Swallows also have a bed bug associated with them that sucks their blood. And so that would also take care of that.
So would it be effective to do that before the nests are actually starting to be built, or would you wait
yes.
till the eggs are laid?
No, I think you could put it in there and it would have enough residual to give you the effect, because where the mites are getting brought into the situation is on the adult birds.
Chance for another question by any chance?
Okay.
I live on the Bay, and what they call green bayflies. Bayflies used to come around Memorial Day weekend. We'd get them by the billions. There'd be big clouds over the trees and things. Over the last decade or so, that main hatch has been decreased in number, but now we've been seeing way, way more, two and three different types of species, different kinds of species, that come later in the spring and into the early summer, and there's just a big hatch again last night. I'm wondering if there's different species that have come in on ocean-going vessels that haven't been identified, or what's going on? Why has there been such a change in their populations?
Well, you know, it may just be the dynamics of the bay. I mean, it's a different species, but Lake Winnebago, of course, with their famous Lake Winnebago fly, was extremely problematic from the 60s all the way into the 90s, and then almost disappeared, and there was lots of concern, and even, you know, the sturgeon, which depended on them, were declining.
Yeah.
And now they're starting to make a comeback, and you know, I'm not sure we understand all the dynamics there, but I think differences in water temperature change in pollution levels do affect the insect fauna. And I don't think the ones you're seeing later are necessarily new species. I just think there are species that are doing better considering the changes, and the traditional fly, for whatever reason, is not. Now, sometimes this is complicated. If you've got new fish that come in that feed on certain things, that could be part of the dynamic that I don't understand here. But we even see in the Madison area, we're, you know, blessed with having four lakes. And, you know, we had an emergence of caddis flies about 2 weeks ago. They were piling up all over on campus next to our university buildings because they're attracted to light. In my 30 years of practicing entomology and living in Madison, I've never seen this. But for whatever reason, the dynamics. So you do get those kind of interesting associations, too, at times. But it is a concern that the traditional green bayfly is not doing what it did before. I mean, to me, that is a flag that there's something that's changed.
Yep. Yeah, I would think it's going to goof up a lot of the birds at time they're hatching to the, I mean, time the hatching of the eggs to the
yes.
emergence of all these bugs. They don't
right.
think it's going to goof up everything over here. But thanks for your help.
Yep, thanks, Mark. Mike in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, guys. Phil, after hearing you talk to open the segment, I'm unsure if I should ask you about the identification of a particular spider, but I'm going to try anyway.
Mm-hmm.
My girlfriend's four-year-old son, they live in the Neenah area, and their apartment has quite a few spiders, more than I've ever seen in an area before. But about a month ago, he woke up with a large welt on his back, and it turned out to be something that grew worse and worse as the days went on. And a large amount of green pus ended up coming out of his back, and it got very infected. And he ended up having to go to the hospital multiple times for shots. And what they did was they took blood samples and determined that, at least the doctors determined what they thought it was a spider bite. And I guess I was going to ask you if there's a spider out there that the body will have that kind of a reaction, when bitten, where the
sure.
amount of pus that was coming out would fill an entire towel. And
sure.
it had to be drained many times.
Well, you know, the most classic one, if you get on the internet, the spider that they will talk that causes ulceration, slow healing bites and whatnot is the brown recluse. And interesting enough, well, a couple points is the recluse is not established in the state. When we get this kind of severe reaction, I definitely do consider this a strong possibility of being a spider bite, because that's what spiders do. Their venom causes tissue damage. Now, the other thing, though, that has been coming out a lot, in particular, one of the frustrations, and we've talked on the show before, is that recluse gets diagnosed a lot of times in states it's not found. In fact, the figures that I've seen is half the diagnosis of that spider bite is in states where the spider isn't, which means it's not a correct diagnosis. And as people have been digging into it, to be honest, whether initially there were spider bites or not, what they're finding is a lot of these cases that were diagnosed as recluse are including some of these antibiotic-resistant staphs that cause the tissue damage. So there are secondary infections that are really causing the majority of the tissue damage and not the spider bite itself. And so that's why we always want to be careful here. And, of course, unfortunately, these kind of infections are on the increase because they're not controlled by antibiotics. So it could be it was a spider bite, but we don't have any spider that inherently does that kind of thing. But again, to me, it was the complicating factor of secondary infections that caused, unfortunately, I'm sure, the child's most of the problem that was going on there.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And we'll go to Marilyn next. Marilyn in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope this hasn't been covered already. I have what looks like small hornets in the eaves of my house. I just noticed, like, the last few days, there is a mesh, supposedly to prevent this sort of thing, I'm sure, that runs along the soffit. But there they are, and they are busy.
Now, do you see any visible nests on the outside?
No.
Okay.
No, and I don't.
Do you see them disappearing in a hole in the soffit, or are they just kind of flying around the soffit?
Well, I think they're getting in around or through that mesh.
Okay.
Maybe the mesh is loose or something up there. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, one of the things that we usually try to determine is it one of these nesting ones that get bigger and bigger over time? And there are species that will nest in attic voids and wall spaces. And so if they're all disappearing in there, that would be my suspicion. What I was trying to clarify is that then we do have other species like mud daubers that make these small little structures that aren't really true nests.
Right. Yeah, I don't see that at all. But it could be inside. I don't know.
Well, probably not, other than I do see mud daubers sometimes underneath shutters and the like. Anytime there's any kind of spacing that's protected, they'll get into. Now, I guess the point, even if it is one of these yellow jackets or the like making a big paper wasp nest in the attic, when it's in a space like that, it's probably not worth going after. You know, what will happen is they will eventually die out when we get into October. And they don't reuse the nest. And
oh, good.
You're always, you know, taking the risk of, you know, when you go to try to treat a nest, that is a risk. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't need to be taken. So, you know, this is one of the cases that if it was right outside the front door and people were walking by the area, you say, boy, you do got to treat. There's just too much of a chance of people getting stung. But if it's up in an area, you know, on a two-story house up in the eaves, you say, or even a ranch, you know, as long as it's not an area of a lot of traffic, I'm not sure I'd bother with it.
Right. Oh, it really doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
At all. I just wondered if I should do something about it. And what purpose do these little critters serve?
Well, you know, wasps are all predators. And, you know, some of them collect caterpillars, some of them collect flies, you know. And so in the general scheme of things, they are beneficial. They're going after things. Now, you know, this German yellow jacket that's been in the state for about the last three decades, unfortunately, in the late summer, becomes a scavenger on sugar and protein. And then as people are trying to eat and drink outside, it becomes a real stinker. And we have a lot of problems with that. But earlier in the season, and even at that time, the only reason they're becoming scavengers is there's just not enough insect food there to support them. And so they're looking for other sources of food to feed their young.
Sure.
I see. Well, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Marilyn, for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or Madison at 263-1890. And let's take another call. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
In Germantown. How are you?
I'm okay.
What can we do for you?
Well, there was this really unusual insect like I've never seen before. It was acting like a hummingbird, and its flight pattern was like a hummingbird. It kept going around flowers. It was about an inch, three-quarters of an inch to an inch long. And it had some yellow and black stripes on, must be the back end, and it looked like red velvet over the middle section of it.
Mm-hmm.
What could it be that acted like a hummingbird?
Yeah, there's a family of moths. Well, the caterpillars are called hornworms,
okay.
And the adults are often referred to as hawk moths or sphinx moths, but some people will also refer to them as hummingbird moths because the way they fly in behavior is very similar, And there's a number of species. I mean, we talk about the tobacco hornworm and the white line sphinx, but, you know, with that yellow, there is an Abbott sphinx. That little pinkish, though, would make a different one. But if you look under hawkmoth, there are a number of species, and they will range from an inch to, honestly, 3 inches in body size, depending on the species.
Okay.
Most of them are active at dusk and dawn, but we do have some that will be active in the day.
Yeah, this was about maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. And, they have a very long proboscis that they unwind in
there. It looked like it.
Yeah, and feed on nectar. I guess the thing when I talk to people, if the hummingbird has antennae, we know it's a moth and not a hummingbird.
Okay. And how common are these things?
Well, more common than I think people realize. I mean, if you had the time to sit in your backyard and watch your flowers, I think you'd see more of them. But I will tell you, I guess in our flower garden, I don't go through a summer without seeing some.
Okay.
And there are about 850 species of hawk moths.
Right, and in Wisconsin, I would say we're probably at about 25.
Wow!
And in the tropics, they've got some huge ones. You know, it's typical; most of the insects are bigger in the tropics, and they're fun. I mean, they're a great photographic subject if you can get one slowed down enough to take a picture. And some of them have just very interesting. They're very popular with moth collectors because they're very streamlined in the way their wings are formed, but they also have so many interesting eye spots and colors, and they really are very attractive.
It was. It was beautiful. That reddish velvet was, and its flight pattern was so unusual.
Yeah, they scurry, and as I said, it reminds one of a hummingbird because they're real fast, and all of a sudden they stop on a dime.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Chris.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yep. Joe in Wisconsin Dells, on to you. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I know you're an entomologist, but I've heard some questions about spiders, and I've wondered for a long time, do spiders make any noises?
Usually not per se, but there are some spiders that can, we call it stridulating, and that's just rubbing one thing against another and making a sound. And there are some spiders that do stridulate.
Like a cricket would.
Yeah, but not as pronounced. I've seen spiders stridulate in a cage or whatnot, but not something that you have to be awful close to hear it. Not something that you would hear from, you know, like a cricket that you can hear from 10, 20 yards away.
Okay.
All right.
This is something I've always wondered about.
Thanks for calling. Gail in Wauwatosa, on to you. Hi, Gail.
Hello. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, is there a bee-looking insect that is red? I was witnessing this. I think it was in my garden, but I was just so awed by it, and it looked exactly like a bee, but it was like a ruby red, and the wings as well, except that in the abdomen there was kind of like a little black spot or towards the top part of the abdomen.
Boy, I'm aware of some of the tropical bees that get metallic-y red. I'm just not... right now I'm not thinking of any that are in Wisconsin, but... You know, we got enough critters, and Phil does see things all the time he's never seen before. And so it would not surprise me. Now, by red, you mean, you know, bright red like an apple, or is it?
No, a deeper red.
Okay, yeah. Well, even then, again, there's one clear-winged hawk moth that's sometimes called a hummingbird clear-wing, and it is a bee mimic, like a bumblebee. But if you look at it, you know, you can tell it, and it's a better flyer than a bumblebee. It's quicker. And that one has kind of a reddish undertone to its body. So that would be one thought, but there could be some other critters too. So,
yeah, this was about the size of a honeybee, so it wasn't as big as a bumblebee. It wasn't furry, you know, real furry.
Mm-hmm.
But it had, you know, the back end of a bee, so it just looked very similar. Anyway, it was very interesting. It's kind of on the color of, I believe it's the crane fly that can get, there's some species of crane flies that are red.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Anyway, that type of red.
Well, so. You know, the other possibility, there is a number of fly families that are bee mimics, too, and it could have been one of those, and some of those do get somewhat brightly colored, although, as I said, just off the top, I can't think of a given species that for sure fits that description. But
okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. And Linda in Mount Horeb, you're next. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I don't know if you can help me identify this. It looked like a fluke that you see in the water. But I was in the garden a couple weeks ago, and I saw this piece of white string trying to corkscrew itself into the ground. And I picked it up and put it in a jar, and it was soft-bodied, and it was probably about 2 or 3 inches long. But it corkscrew itself. It seemed, you know, you really couldn't tell the head from the tail.
Was it real skinny, though?
Yes. It was like a piece of string.
Sure. My guess is horsehair worm, which is a parasite of crickets and grasshoppers and other insects. And, in fact, they get bigger than that. I've seen horsehair worms up to 6 inches long, but very thin. You often see them after rains, and they have come out of a cricket, which they're an internal parasite of that, but they're harmless to people, and that would fit. And I wonder, as things dry out, it was probably trying to get into the soil where it's protected from the sunlight and the moisture levels are higher.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. James in Heartland, on to you. Hi, James.
Hi. I've got a question as far as millipedes. I think that's what they are.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They look like a little worm with a lot of legs.
Yep.
How do you get rid of them?
Well, millipedes feed on organic matter. And so one of the problems that we see, and it's typically the fall, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, I get these complaints all the time.
I get them in the basement.
Right. Now, they're not breeding there. That's the first thing I can assure you. They're breeding in the soil. And what happens with millipedes is they do their crawling around and things at night. And when the sun comes up, they're looking for places that are cool, damp, and dark.
Okay.
And if they're getting in your basement, I think the problem usually is where your foundation meets the siding. They can crawl up that and squeeze through, and literally it's like going over a wall and they fall in. And so the first thing you would look at is what you can seal. Make sure that all your vents are sealed. And even maybe consider shooting some expanding foam or some similar product to seal that interface so that they can't squeeze in. Now, step two, if that doesn't work, they're often associated with the mulch around the foundation. So if you were to call a pest control service, they would come and treat the outside foundation of the house with a chemical, trying to knock the numbers down. Where I find people get quite frustrated, especially if you live in rural areas and you're next to a 40-acre pasture, they can breed by the millions in those situations, and they start to migrate. And this is the one that we see more in the fall. But again, I've had complaints this year already of millipedes migrating in. People say, every morning I have 600 dead millipedes on my garage floor.
Right.
Well, you think about the garage floor, it's cool, damp, and dark. And so as the sun comes up, they're literally drawn to it. And so what the people will do is spray the floor, which isn't very effective. I mean, you might as well just sweep up what's there. But what I try to get people to think about is, where is there a source of organic matter that these things are breeding? And it's not your lawn grass, because that's really usually, unless you've got...
So it could be a compost pile.
Could be a compost pile. Could be, as I said, if you've got an old field next to you. And so knowing that they're migrating from there, you can put your treatment out farther, the barrier. Some people will go on with a drop spreader and put some of the insecticide that we normally would use in the lawn for grubs into a 4 or 5 foot swath between where they're coming from and where their lawn starts. Why that is more effective than treating your foundation is you get them before they get to you.
And so
that's part of it, is trying to think this through, is where is the most likely source and what makes the most sense as far as is treating it. And again, I can assure you, whatever's getting in your basement is falling in. They may live for a few days if they're lucky, if your basement's damp, but most of the time people just find lots of dead ones.
Right.
And they just
I see them crawling around in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're probably dead by night.
Right. So as I said, I think the first step is, if you can physically seal them out, that's permanent. If that doesn't work, then you look at what these chemical treatments, and again, try to put your, think about where the most likely source is and get between them and you and put your treatment down.
Okay.
Thanks, James.
The other thing is there a insect coming in? Down south, they used to have them there. I think they call them a Japanese beetle.
Oh, yeah.
We got lots of those.
Bright colored.
Yeah, my major call right now statewide is Japanese beetle. And, some people have been dealing with it for 10 years. Some people are just dealing with it. And it is the most miserable insect in the world if you like to grow plants, because it feeds on 300 different varieties of trees and shrubs. It loves grapes. It loves raspberries. It loves roses, birch trees, linden trees. And they're active for about 2 months. And one of the problems is that they don't necessarily breed on your lawn. I mean, if they're eating your rose bush or your potentilla, they could be coming from a half mile or so down the road. And it just gets so frustrating. And so, you know, certain plants people stop growing, or you're spraying every week to keep them off. And it just makes gardening not very much fun. And yes, unfortunately, Japanese bee lichen draw a line from Green Bay to Eau Claire south. In fact, even north of Eau Claire, I know we're getting a little bit of problems right now. And they will continue till about the 1st of September.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, James. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Karen in Portage has a question, so let's go to Karen. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. I live on a farm, and I'm used to the dog climbing in bed with us and donating her ticks. But something was causing bites that itch like crazy infrequently in that. So I'm thinking fleas, lice, which she doesn't have. Well, yesterday morning, I felt something going on, and I whipped the cover off and found this tiny little bug like a fat, squat sesame seed. And I looked in the book. It wasn't a flea because it didn't have a little pointy butt. And I couldn't figure out what, and then all of a sudden, my mother's ghost kicked me and said, "Chiggers." And I had completely forgotten about chiggers. And it resembles the picture of the chiggers, but it has a lighter band around its body.
Yeah, I'd be more inclined to think it's an immature tick than a chigger.
It wasn't a tick because it... You know, I get these bites all the time, not frequently, but, and, you know, around the waistband and anywhere where there's constriction, and they itch like crazy.
Yeah, well, that's typical of chiggers. And chiggers are a very small mite, and they tend to be reddish. I mean, rather bright red. And they're small enough, to be honest, that, you know, without some kind of magnification, I'm not sure when I see them that they truly are chiggers or not. And that's why I was just wondering if they're slightly bigger than that. That, I mean, there are some bigger mites, too.
Well, this
but...
was smaller than a little deer tick, and it was dark brown. And the picture that I have is black and white, but it says they're dark brown. And it was almost a roundish shape with the point for the head, and I magnified, and you could see, like, a proboscis on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are some other mites, but chiggers tend to be a little bit almost velvety in color. I mean, a little bit hairy under magnification. And as I said, I tend to find they're small enough that, you know, this sounds more like there are some ticks that are armored or shield. They have these little coverings on the back and mites. Boy, if you had the critter, I'd be more than happy to take a peek at it. I'm then for sure I think we could verify.
Okay, the thing is, you know, I pinched him and he died instantly. And ticks, you can crush those things.
But not the immature stages. The immature stages are not near as armored as the adult ticks.
But would that cause the bites like I'm getting?
It depends on what the critter is. There are some mites that no way could ever bite you, and there's some that are. Typically, the ones that do are the ones that are parasites.
But the bites that are red and itch like crazy, and then they kind of get a little head in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, that's characteristic of chiggers.
But I can't see them.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Donna in Eau Claire, hi to you.
Hi, I'm having a terrible time. With the name goes out of my mind. The bugs that jump and crickets. Thank you. Sorry. Mm-hmm. In the last 2 years, it's the first that we've had a problem with it. We live the north end of Eau Claire. We have a two-story home. They come in, I think, through the back door out of the laundry room because I have found them in the track of the door when you open it a couple times. I had gotten a spray. It's called Home Defense Max. That somebody had recommended, excuse me, to spray inside and outside. There's a bush that's very close to the back door that could be an area where they're hibernating in. They come in and go into one room, I would say 95% of the time in this one room, and the only way I'm able to catch them, kill them, is I have a bottle of Windex down there, and I douse them. I can get close to that, catch them as they're jumping, and douse them with that, and then pick them up and throw them away. And last year I got 37 of them, which is just a little frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of recommendations do you have?
Are you in somewhat of a rural area?
No. We're It's residential. It's not far from the bluff going down to the wells in that general area.
Are they black crickets or are they brownish crickets?
Oh, they're black.
Okay.
And they do jump. And I hear the noise at times, so I know it's a cricket.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to differentiate. There is something called a camel or cave cricket that we do get in the state, too, but this sounds more like the field crickets that most people are familiar with.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what I think would be important to still, as best you can, identify where these little stinkers are coming from outside.
Mm-hmm.
The home defense that you spray, you know, will take some time to work, and whether you got dead or live crickets in the house, you're not going to be happy. And so I think the line of defense is more of trying to figure out where they're coming from outside and treat that directly and try to kill them and knock the populations down before they get to you. And, you know, crickets are vegetation feeders. They don't do well in standard mode lawns, but other habitat that is more diverse, you know, more lush flower beds and whatnot's a possibility. If that was determined to be the source, then you can even get some of these granular insecticides and just throw them out on the mulch and just go through a normal watering, and that should knock them down. But I think that the point now is, you know, with a little bit of going out there and poking around to see if you can find where there's lots of little crickets jumping, and then get after that spot. And as I said, I think that will probably give you a better satisfaction than spraying the door sill and whatnot, which, as I said, you know, if you're spraying concrete or a similar surface, it isn't even worth treating. Because the insecticide just is like a sponge. It just gets all absorbed. And as I said, so I would look at trying to get more at the outside source and use that as my defense.
Okay. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate it. And Kurt in Cornucopia, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Yes, I was hoping you could help me to determine what kind of food source a particular caterpillar I have requires. Because I've got a bush growing by my front door called an angelica, and it's got a bunch of these caterpillars on it, and the angelica has died at this point, and they're hungry, and there's nothing left for them to eat. So I tried moving one to another plant, and it didn't like it, and I'm assuming they're pretty plant-specific. So I was hoping if I could describe it to you, you might give me some ideas.
Sure, I'll give it a try.
Well, it's fairly big. It's almost as big as my little finger, maybe more like 2 inches long. There's a bunch of them, very segmented. There's about 13 segments, sort of like a corrugated cardboard. It's kind of iridescent green, and it's got, at each segment, a band of kind of a yellower band with black spots or black leopard parts in the banding. And it's fatter at the front end, and it's got fat little legs.
Hmm.
Boy, the problem with moths is we've got a couple thousand species. I think if I saw a picture of it, I may be able to give you a better idea. But I think you are going to be somewhat handcuffed on the host-specific side of things, is that most of those things, well, two things. One of the thoughts is they honestly are getting big enough. I wonder if they're going to spin down and you're still going to get moths off of it.
Some of them, there's quite a few. Some of them are only maybe a half an inch long.
Okay, those ones are in trouble without a new food source.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what plant family that belongs to?
I don't, but I guess I could look up angelica and get a better idea.
Yeah, I mean, that's the direction you have to go, is get something closely related. You know, it's interesting, and if I had to, nothing else was available, the thing that I would try is apple.
Okay.
Believe it or not, apple is, I mean, that's one of the reasons it's hard to grow apples, is lots of things like apple, and so that would be one. But going back, I mean, some things, you know, much like we all know about monarchs, the only thing they can feed on is milkweed, and without that, they would starve to death. I mean, they just would refuse. And that's quite characteristic of many caterpillars. And but again, I offer, if you've got a digital camera, take a picture, send it down to the diagnostic lab, and then I'm pretty sure I can put a name on it. There was a really neat book that came out about a year and a half ago called The Caterpillars of Eastern North America. And although by no means does it have all the caterpillars, it has a lot of these very interesting, unique ones. And it also shows you the moth that it will grow up to be. And that was a reference, to be honest, an area that really, until that book came, we did not have a good picture book per se to help people identify things. But I think there's like 400 or 500 species pictured very well in that book. And that's usually the reference that I go to when I'm trying to identify something.
Okay. Could you give me the website address at some point for
sure.
That digital photo?
Sure. Well, my email is a shortening of my last name. It's Pellitte, Pellitte, at entomology, entomology.wisc, pellitteria.edu.
Could you give me the first Pelletier again?
It's P-E-L-L-I-T-T-E.
Okay.
All right.
I'll fire you off a photo.
All right. That's good. Thanks, Gert. And on to Bob, I believe, in Union Center. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have about 50 milkweed plants of several species to attract monarch butterflies. And despite watering, these plants are stressed. And I think the development of the caterpillars is stressed as a result. There's regular egg laying, but not much hatching. And the caterpillars are not big and robust. And I find small ones wandering around away from the milkweeds. I also find desiccated ones. Is this terrible drought a stress
on the monarchs?
Yeah. Well, we do find is plant leaves wilt and whatnot. Nutritionally, insects don't do near as well on it. There is a certain amount of water and whatnot that's required in their diet. The other thought, though, is I can't rule out that some of these are not diseased. You know, one of the problems that we have when we try to rear insects and kind of keep their densities together is we do get disease problems. And one of the patterns of the disease is things just don't thrive and kind of wander and, you know, as you say, kind of shrivel up rather than going the other way. So that's one other possibility.
Okay. Phil Pelletier, our guest UW Extension entomologist here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects now with Phil Pelletier, UW Extension entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Phil, before we go to the phones, what's the status of the quarantine? We've got 41 Wisconsin counties that are kind of quarantined to slow the spread of gypsy moths. The weather had much effect on them?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think any place that I saw a gypsy moth, they had a heck of a good year. You hate to say this, but nice springs are good for gypsy moths. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't see some of the natural diseases. I would envision when the numbers start coming in, they're right now starting to collect the moth traps, that yeah. we will see an increase. There may be more counties put on the quarantine. And so, unfortunately, we didn't get the break like we did 2 years ago with the weather to help knock the populations down, and we're all paying for it. And even in the Madison area, we saw defoliation levels we have never seen before of whole huge baroque trees with not a leaf on them in, you know, towards the end of May, beginning of June.
Mm. And, of course, when they don't have any leaves on them and there's no water.
Well, you know, it's interesting that these trees did leaf out just fine this year. Because it's the first year it happened. And if you think about it, this tree is going back on the energy reserves it stored in 2006. If this gypsy moth breaks out again on these same trees, it'll look for what's in the bank for 2007, and there's nothing there. So that's when we start getting in real trouble. And again, the drought stress on top of it. And so what typically happens with oaks is there's an insect called a chestnut borer that likes stress. Well, you put drought stress and defoliation from gypsy moth, you lose the oaks.
No. Robert in Coloma, we'll go to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hello to both of you. I'm trying to identify an ant. Each spring I get a minor invasion of these black ants. They're about 3/10 of an inch long, and they will eat both sweet and protein.
Yeah, they're carpenter ants.
They are
yeah.
That was my question. Are they carpenter ants?
Yeah, I mean, just on any middle to large black ant that wants to come in your kitchen turns out to be carpenter ants. I mean, if they're smaller ants, there are a handful of possibilities. And what I always tell people is, you know, carpenter ants are on every property in the state. They live in rotting stumps, in bad wood and trees, and everybody's got trees on their lot. And, you know, what we're often trying to sort through is, are they nesting indoors? And so if you said, well, I saw some ants in January, well, then there's no question that there's only way they can come. It's a little bit more difficult in the spring. If you start seeing them in early to mid-March, I get suspicious they're in an outside wall that was too cold in January, but it's not warm enough outside to get the ants from the trees. If they only show up in May, then it's just as good a possibility that the nest is outside. They're coming in for food. Once more food becomes available outdoors, they stop coming in. They kind of break their habit. And so I wouldn't lose any sleep on this, but it's something just to kind of bear watching. And, you know, if other things happen, you found a bunch of wing forms by a windowsill one day or whatnot, that would indicate they're indoors. But other than that kind of evidence, as I said, you're probably just recruiting some ants from outside.
Okay.
Yes, I believe that's the latter case.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Gene in Milwaukee. Hello to you.
Hi.
I just have a couple of questions. I was sitting on my deck the other night, and I was watching this wasp on my fountain. Do wasps drink water?
Yes.
Yeah.
They do?
Yes.
That was so interesting. I was watching, and it was just drinking away. It's really been dry. But anyway, the other question I have is around my property, and I found two in the house, and it's like, I don't know if it's a beetle. It flies, because one flew past me the other night. Well, it was still daylight, but it was, you know, about 6 o'clock or something like that, and it's a big black kind of oval shape and about, I would say, 1 1/4 inches long. It's real huge. I mean, it's really big, and it's pitch black. Mm-hmm. And what is that?
A couple possibilities. Right now, one of the things that I'm seeing are stag beetles coming in. These are, in fact, some cases 2 inches long and have some pretty good jaws. Even smaller than that, though, which, because the black color you described, there is a type of scarab beetle called Osmoderma, or some people refer to it as the leather beetle. They look like big June beetles, you know, might be a way of describing them. And that would be my first guess from that kind of size.
Do they bite or hurt?
No, don't hurt anything. They also breed in rotting stumps like the carpenter ants. And,
oh, really?
The adults, again, are really quite interesting. You know, for people who like to collect insects, both because of the size and whatnot, they're a specimen that they often would want to collect, and but again, they're harmless, just like a June beetle. They you know, they don't bite, they don't do anything other than just kind of, they're kind of clumsy when they're not flying in front.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one other thing, can you do anything about killing a birch borer once it starts destroying the birch?
If more than a third of the tree is gone, probably not.
Okay.
If less than that, the newer product that they're using is a systemic where they put it in the ground and it goes up through the roots, and
mm-hmm.
it really works quite well. It's sold as the homeowner formulation is Bayer's tree and shrub insecticide.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem, if more than a third of the tree is dead, there's so much physical damage to the cambial tissue that it won't move the insecticide.
I see.
So that's where the problem is that, you know, if the moving vessels in the tree are intact, we can move the insecticide, but if they're cut off because of the insect feeding, then it won't move to where it needs to go.
And the birch borer does, like, kill the tree from top to bottom.
Yes.
That's mm-hmm. correct. Okay, yeah. That's what I've got. Okay, thank you very much.
And
sure.
Typically, it hits a tree that's already under stress.
Right. And, you know, right now, people who have birch trees, if you're not watering them, you're asking for it. Because, you know, birch is shallow-rooted. It's very prone to drought stress. And so it's very interesting. Trees that maybe were limping along, we find we'll get stressed out in a year like this year, the borer will move in, and then it'll take 2 to 3 years average to kill the tree. And people don't think about the proper care of the tree now prevents the borer in the future.
On to Dave in Green Bay. Dave, hello to you.
Hi. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Dave.
I think that the gentleman who had the caterpillars on his Angelica
mm-hmm.
might be wise, since Angelica is in that celery family plant, like cow parsnips and the like, to move those to a celery family plant.
Well, you know what that brings, his description, but I didn't realize it was in the celery family.
Well,
he probably has black swallowtails.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. So he could move them to parsley, he could move them to dill, he could move them to lovage, depending on what he's got in his herb garden or garden, especially the parsley. When they get on the parsley, I share the parsley with the caterpillar.
Yeah, what's interesting is he's got so many, because typically you only find one or two of those. So if he's got a group of them, he's real fortunate.
So he should try to move as many as possible. But I think even if he had some, you know, regular celery plants, he might try moving them on then. And I probably, if I were moving them, I'd spread them around to as many plants as possible so they don't devour something entirely.
Yep. Good.
Okay.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Good points. On to Sandy in Wausau. Sandy, hello to you.
Hey, hi. How are you doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a little tiny black bug that has devastated my nasturtiums, and now they're on my kohlrabi, and they're eating the heck out of it, and the leaves just look like lace.
Okay.
There's a ton of them. There's a million of them on.
Do they
on
jump it. When you touch them?
Yes.
Yeah, they're flea beetles.
Oh, ew.
And flea beetles, and the name comes from that fact that they jump and they do chew things. And
we
have a number of different species. Are you an organic gardener or not?
Yes.
Okay, then the product you're looking for is rotenone. It's a dust that you put on it, and it is effective against flea beetles.
Ooh, how do you spell that?
R-O-T-E-N-N-O-N-E, I think it is.
R-O-T-E-N-O-N-E. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll try it.
Give it a shot. and on to Dean in Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, Dean.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, guys, I got a critter in my pool that it's got little wings. If you were to shrink a blue whale right down to a quarter inch or 3/8, this little guy is a fast guy. And we can net them out, you know, just seine them out real quick with a net. But these guys are prevalent. They just keep coming back.
Yeah, what the experience in pools is, there are a number of aquatic insects, whether they're back swimmers or aquatic beetles, that in the summer fly around and look for ponds because they're moving to new territories. It's mm-hmm. a dispersal thing. And the pool, unfortunately, is recognized to them as just another water source. And so they do come flying in. And one of the things that you may consider is, since a lot of these fly at night, is trying to be careful with your lighting, because that may be at first drawing them in the area, and then when they see the reflected surface, it's time for them to dive bomb in. But unfortunately, I don't have any other good solutions for it, because again, they're a migrating insect that's coming in with the winds.
Sure, and I did research the internet, and even the name that I got on these guys was Water Boatman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just another family of you know, whether, as I said, there's about, I could think of 15 different groups of insects that are, again, what we refer to as aquatic insects that do fly, go back and forth. In fact, what a lot of these insects will do as the ponds dry up, of course, they have to have a way of flying to some big lake or a bigger source of water. So that's part of it, too.
Sure.
And it may be one of the reasons this year, with the dryness going on, is there's less ponds, which makes your pool even more attractive.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and do you have lights on, underwater lights?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, if you take those, you might want to turn those off.
When you're not using the pool.
Or the neighborhood pool, or you know, the friends come over. The one thing I would toss out there, just an FYI or even something to educate me, is the fact that when I started finding beetles, I'm a hobby farmer and I got a farm behind me, and these guys rotate their soy and their corn, and you know, for cattle feed. Mine is sweet corn, but I find these beetles out there. And lo and behold, I forget the name of them. The beetles seem to be in the family of the bowmen. Is that?
Yeah, no, they look similar, but they're quite different.
Okay.
The water boatman is technically a true bug.
Okay.
It has a sucking mouth part and the like, whereas, you know, the picnic beetles that you run into sweet corn are shaped and colored very similar, so I could see where that would be my guess what you got going on there, but they're not related.
Okay, wonderful.
Thanks, Dean.
Well, thank you, guys.
You bet. Dennis in Eau Claire, hi to you.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm a truck driver. And I was recently down and pulled in a restaurant to get out and eat, and there was a butterfly that looked like one of these black and gold ones. Are those monarch butterflies?
Yeah.
But this one was probably 10, with its wingspan from tip to tip, probably 10 to 12 inches wide. Its body was bigger than a Nutter Butter cookie. You know what I mean? I mean, it was just huge. It's probably 8 inches from nose to tail.
Okay.
But it was just beautiful, like one of them black, real silky looking with the gold, just like one of the smaller butterflies. Why was that one so big? And are they?
Where did you see this butterfly?
I seen it. I stopped at a restaurant and flew right when I went to open my door. It landed right at the bottom of my. I got pictures of it. I didn't want to grab a hold of it because it was just so big and beautiful.
And what state were you in?
I was in Mississippi.
Oh, Mississippi.
Yeah.
Well, you know, because of the size of the body, I'm more inclined to think it's a wild silkworm moth than a butterfly, because they tend to be, as you say, you know, as big as your thumb or so. There is one called an imperial moth that is both a yellow base and kind of a brownish markings on the wing. So that would be my first guess.
This is really beautiful, just like the butterflies my granddaughter catches up here in Wisconsin, you know, the gold ones with the black, but it was just beautiful.
Well, up here we get the giant swallowtail is active right now, and that fits that description, but it has these little tails, and the body is much more delicate. As I said, I know it's a wild silkworm, and I would guess it's an imperial moth, but they've got hickory horn devils. I mean, they have some things down there we just don't see up here, and, you know, they are attracted to lights quite commonly, so they'll be drawn into the truck stops. And again, they do have some impressive wingspans. Although 10 inches is
and
I would
big.
Say maybe 6 to 7 on some of them. But again, there may be a species down south that I'm not aware of.
Oh. Yeah, I took pictures of it, and I was gonna. I'll listen to your show because I know you'll give your address again. I'll send you some pictures of it. I mean, you can tell from looking out from a window of my truck to the gravel is not that far, but this thing is huge.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the address at the insect lab is
1630.
Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N mm-hmm. Drive.
Uh-huh.
Madison, and the university zip is 53706. And just send it to the insect lab. I get everything that comes in. So.
Do you have all digital right. pictures?
Yeah, I took it with my digital camera.
Oh, you could send
okay,
it.
Okay, well, then send it to my email, which is Pellitte, P-E-L-L-I-T-T-E.
Yeah.
At entomology is entomology.wisc.edu.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling. That'll be fun to see that one.
Yeah. And you know, right now, Larry, as times have changed, right now, 40% of what I'm processing in the lab are digital images that people are sharing with me, and it's a it's just a delight. In fact, I always tease that the greatest thing that's happened to me in my career is a digital camera. So I'm running around taking pictures of all kinds of bugs. And in fact, I've got more pictures on my computer than I probably should. But it's just a great way of seeing what's going on out there. And then, as I said, sharing it with people. And you know, there are websites, too. There's one called Bug Guide where you can submit and they will help identify. And what's neat is they've been databasing all these pictures now. And so there are literally tens of thousands of images. And it's a little bit of a tough site if you don't know what you're looking for. You know, if you just say butterfly, they'll throw so many butterflies at you, you won't get through it. But if you know which species or have a guess, it's a great resource.
Jill in Middleton, your turn now. Hi, Jill.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
A couple of weeks ago, Phil was talking to somebody who had called in about this huge black waspy thing that I guess is parasitic. And I can't remember what he called it. He said it didn't have a common name. It only has the Latin name.
Yeah. The family are ichneumonids. It's probably Megarissa, which is a parasite of horntails, and it's, you know, if you stretch the critter out, it could be 8 or 9 inches, but about 5 of those inches are what people would refer to as a stinger, but it's really the egg-laying device. So that's the one that we were talking about?
Yep, that sounds like the one. Okay. Do they nest? Because I'm noticing something that I think is the Megarissa. It must have a nest underneath our garage.
Yeah, no, they do not nest. In fact, the only thing they do is fly onto trees to lay their eggs. In fact, that's where a lot of them get caught. So there's
okay.
no nest per se, no collecting prey. They just lay their eggs, and then their grubs develop on these wood borers.
Okay, because what we've got is it's a large black. It looks like a wasp. It's got the two pieces coming down from the abdomen,
mm-hmm.
and it's been carrying around full size grasshoppers.
Yeah, the big wasps that we have in the thread waisted group. There's both a cicada killer. There are cricket hunters. One's called the golden digger wasp, but that's also a cricket hunter that goes after cicadas.
Okay.
And in all those cases, and they can be upwards of, the stingers are not as visible on these as it is in the Megarissa, but they go out and paralyze their prey, dig holes in the ground, drop their prey in. And again, the different wasps have certain prey they concentrate on. There's mm-hmm. a large number of smaller ones that go after leafhoppers and little things, but that doesn't catch people's attention. We've got a lot of cicada killers in the state this year. That's one of the examples that I use to tell people of an insect that usually I said, well, I had to go down to Indiana to find them, and now we find them in Wisconsin Dells, which, you know, is suggesting these mild winters that have been allowing some southern things to move up. We've got a ton of them on campus, and they scare the devil out of people because they're so big,
mm-hmm.
but they're non-aggressive. They really don't have a true nest per se, so they don't, you know, get agitated when you're around them. But they're also quite curious, and the males are quite territorial, so they will come and check you out if you move into an area. But I said those cricket hunters and the like, they'll bury their prey, and after a week or two, they'll seem to disappear. And then for the rest of the grown season and through the winter, their grubs will develop in the ground.
Okay, so do I need to, because I have a puppy who's decided that these things are a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Do I need to worry too much about her getting stung?
Well, the point would be is if the puppy were to snap at him and catch one in the mouth, then there is an issue because
okay.
they will sting.
Okay.
So, if you can't train the puppy not to, for that kind of critter, this is like the ones we talked about before, ground nesting wasps and bees, use a dust like 7-garden dust in the holes that they're going into, and that would do them in.
Okay.
All right.
All right. That sounds great. Thank you.
Thanks, Jill. Pat in Duluth, Minnesota. Your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I had a response to the man from Cornucopia who has caterpillars on his Angelica.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
That's a black swallowtail
yeah.
caterpillar,
yeah, we
which
were,
is a butterfly.
Yeah, we were just talking about that.
Yeah, we got,
sorry, I've been trying to get through, so I haven't had the radio
sure.
on.
Dave Parsons, who is one of the hort assistants up in Green Bay, was nice enough to call back. And the trick was, I didn't realize it was in the salary family. I was suspicious it was a black swallowtail. But the other interesting thing that we had mentioned is that to have a bunch of them is really a treat because usually you find one or two larvae and and those ones that are 2 inches are probably getting pretty close to making a chrysalis.
Yeah, we have a chrysalis right now on our Angelica that I've been watching. But did you get the whole list of host plants then?
Yeah, David talked about anything, parsley and celery would be a possibility.
Right.
Carrot would be another possibility.
And dill and also Queen Anne's lace.
Mm-hmm.
And then common rue, we have not had those in our yard on that, but that's also possible if, they don't have vegetables in their garden.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, thanks for sharing.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad that information got out.
Thanks, Pat. Bob in Eau Claire, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. My wife and I have just moved into the Eau Claire area from north central Minnesota. And one of the things that we've noticed is, first of all, the soil here is very, very sandy, which is different from what we're used to. And we have mosquitoes and deer flies and common biting bugs like that. But here, there are no cium-sized bugs. They're almost like a flea, but they've got a really nasty bite on them. And I'm just kind of curious what those might be, and is there any way to control those?
Well, I'm guessing here a little bit. Up in Eau Claire, about this time of the year, I often get complaints about black flies.
Okay.
Now, but I would think in northern Minnesota, you're familiar with black flies?
Actually, in the area where we were, we didn't get very many.
Okay.
Further north, they're an issue.
Yeah,
but in Aiken County, they weren't.
What they need is moving water. And if it was black flies, they come off the Eau Claire River, and they are gnat-like, look kind of like a fruit fly, maybe a little stouter bodied. But what's very characteristic of their bite is they get you usually around the hairline and around the ears. And although the bite itself, when they first bite, doesn't bother you, it will often bleed when they leave. And then people often develop these really nasty, hard welts that often take a few days to go away. So does that kind of fit what the reaction is?
Yeah, and although they flock around my head,
yes.
They go for my legs. And my legs are just covered with those welts.
Okay, well, they will do that too, although it starts on the head. I mean, that's usually the place in... the problem with that is that you can't go to the breeding site, which is the water. And, anything you can do to promote some more air movement, that black flies are not strong flyers. And so, if the wind speed stays above 10 miles an hour, they're not going to mess with you. But I'll be honest, when I get into very nasty black flies or mosquitoes, when there just doesn't seem to be, much other option and I want to be outdoors, I have one of these little mesh suits. It's a little, very similar to the mesh you find in a tent, and put this little suit on to protect myself. It even has a little hood. So at least the one good news I'll tell you is the black fly season usually only lasts a couple weeks. It's not like it's season long. And so I would think that things should get better over time.
Mm-hmm. And we put a fan out on the lawn when we're just sitting out there, and that keeps them off.
Yep.
Put the fan right on us. Phil, always a pleasure. You'll be back.
About a month,
we'll do this again. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Real pleasure to have him along, and we'll look forward to his next visit. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk summer outings with Eric Hansen, Milwaukee travel writer, and then we'll be talking grilling with beer with Lucy Saunders. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.